This is an extract about, it's just during the time of the wedding of the central character of the book, Ruth, and it takes place in sort of the mid-1950s. She's a student at the Royal College of Music. She's studying the piano, so there's a reference to music. She's about to get married. Every time she thought about anything, it seemed to have a bed in it. In her suitcase was a small round tin, housing a dome of thick dark rubber the colour of a flypaper. Absurdly, this would prevent her from having babies, at least for the time being. She had a final year at the Royal College to see out. Her father had suggested she quit now that she was to be a wife, with wifely things to do, but Harry, her future husband, saw no reason why she should not carry on, and Ruth wanted to. The gynaecologist in Portland Place had instructed her to practice inserting and removing the device before the honeymoon. She must first lie down, get the thing in. Then, after use, a prescribed amount of hours later, she was to remove the thing, wash it in tepid water, never hot, for very hot water could cause the rubber to perish. At last, she must dry it carefully before sprinkling the barest coating of talcum powder over the dome, like dusting icing sugar onto a fairy cake. In her room, she had blushed alone as she removed it from its tin. The bed felt too high, too exposed, so she lay on the narrow rug beside it. First, she tried lying on her back, then on her side. The base of the dome was a sprung ring. The trick was to narrow it between two fingers while probing with the other hand. Once in place, you could let go and the ring would resume its circular form, fitting over what her doctor had told her was called the cervix, like a tiny brimless hat. There was a knack to it, apparently. Evidently, it was a knack she did not possess. The device kept springing out of her hand and across the rug. On one attempt, it jumped several feet as far as the door. Ruth began to laugh, but laughing alone was ridiculous and made it harder to concentrate. It was all quite impossible. It would never fit. It would leap out at Harry on her wedding night, startling as a frog, and she would be too ashamed to face him ever again. For several days, she made no further attempts. The tin sat undisturbed, a shameful secret in the drawer among her underthings. Then, intrepid after a day of studying, she strode home and went straight up to her room, unlaced her shoes, unfastened her suspender belt, and pulled down her woolen stockings and tried again in broad daylight, not lying down as the doctor had told her, but standing up in her bare feet, one foot raised on the chair at the end of the bed. This was the way one of Wagner's Valkyrie would put in her Dutch cap, she thought, and it brought victory. Getting it out, which had worried her, what if it got stuck, turned out to be much easier than putting it in. None of this augured well for the honeymoon, though. There was nothing pleasurable in the probing necessitated by the contraceptive device. How could actual lovemaking be any different? Ruth didn't mean to keep thinking about how it would turn out in that department, but somehow her thoughts always came back to settle on it, like a bee returning again and again to the same plant. She liked kissing. She and Harry had done plenty of that, but she did feel anxious about the next bit. Their room at the hotel by Lake Garda had long wooden shutters and a paper of big orangish flowers. The candlewick bed cover was an anemic tangerine, not the bright colour of a tangerine skin, but the colour of the tight, pithy inside of an underripe fruit. At first, Ruth disliked the room's decor. It embarrassed her somehow, and she gravitated towards the window, which framed a view of blue water, distant villas and air. But by the second morning, she loved it all, the ugly tufted bedspread, the coyness of the spindly chairs, even the stiff bath taps. No wonder people spoke of married bliss. It turned out that what happened in bed was perfectly lovely. You could kiss all the way through, which had surprised her. She had imagined that kissing was only a preliminary, a first course. Nor did you have to keep your eyes shut. You could look, you could kiss any part of each other. You could take as long as you liked. It seemed there was nothing you couldn't do. There were no forbidden zones, and all of it was just the best feeling ever. Their time in bed made her love Harry more than ever, in a slightly dotty way, at once hypnotised and ravenous. It also had the strange effect of making her fall rather in love with herself. Ruth's body was not something she had ever thought much about. She carried it around, dressed it, fed it when it was hungry. When she looked in the glass before going out for an evening, she occasionally tutted at her unshapely legs, her disobliging hair. Now she found herself amazed at her own flesh while she bathed, at her heavy breasts and the freckles on her forearms. She suddenly felt, for the first time, that she might be beautiful.
It's a real privilege to hear your voice. I mean, one's always curious about the sound of novels. I'd do anything to hear Jane Austen's voice, for instance. But, you know, like all readers, I admire your book greatly. I've got some questions. Why did you call it My Former Heart?
Well, I couldn't really think what else to call it. There was a lot of talk about what to call it, and at one point my daughter suggested it should have been called Missing People, because in a way one of its main themes is about how when you love you miss people and it's sad. But then I thought that sounded like sort of a book about the Somme, so I didn't call it that. And then all throughout the composition of the book I'd been reading Wordsworth's poem.
So, sorry, can we cut? Just that plane's a little bit too loud.
No,
of course.
Because of the amount of noise, it's probably best just pausing.
Okay.
Getting the camera rolling.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Right. Speed.
Speed.
Yep. And camera rolling.
Can you do the clap? Yeah.
Speed. Yep.
Thank you.
It's a real in-your-face extract from your novel. And it's such a privilege to hear your voice. One's always curious about the sound of novels. And as I say, it was good to hear that. Why did you call it My Former Heart?
Well, all the time I was working on the book, for some reason I had been reading Wordsworth's poem Tintern Abbey. And the line comes from Tintern Abbey. And there's a very beautiful bit at the end from which that line comes, where he describes going back to this place where he'd visited with his beloved sister Dorothy. And he says, "In your voice I hear the language of my former heart," about her. And I loved the idea that somebody's voice could embody your kind of whole landscape of the heart. And I think a lot of the book is about sort of second chances. So in a way, what I describe throughout it is sort of the first attempts that people have at love and how that can go wrong, and then it goes into a second chance if you're lucky. So I think that's why I called it that. Yes, I was attracted to it.
Well, let's dig a bit into this word about. as I recall, Tintern Abbey starts with a description of long years, and
yes.
Yours is a very long novel chronologically, isn't it? It's got
yes.
three generations of women.
Yes, it has. One of the things I wanted to explore was women who leave their children. It's a thing that had happened in my own family with my grandmother and various other people, and I wrote a biography in which a lot of the women had left their children, and it seemed to me that that was sort of one of the last taboos remaining to us. It's one of the few things that is universally deplored. And so I needed quite a long range in order to be able to do that. I didn't want to just do it in one generation. I wanted to do it across two and possibly three generations, and to see how that might come about, how it could be that a woman would be separated from her children. So in this case, there's the Second World War, and then there's a divorce in which the father gets custody of the children. And then in the next generation, in fact, the person doesn't abandon their child after all. But that was sort of why I wanted to have quite a long canvas, wide canvas, so that I could explore that.
I was struck very much by certain very close-up moments in the novel. I was very moved by the opening, which is a showing of Walt Disney's Dumbo.
Yes.
And then the mother disappears while the little girl's watching. And if you remember, the Disney film is about the separation of child and mother.
Yes.
The elephants. And the same thing happened to me. I watched Dumbo with my mother, and then shortly after, my mother left to go to Argentina.
Oh, how
places.
Extraordinary.
Whereas in your case, the mother goes to the Lebanon.
Yeah.
And it struck me that the actual precision of that was very, very beautiful.
I don't know if
that touched some personal thing in yourself when you
It didn't, in fact.
It.
And oddly, while I was writing it, it only came to me later that Dumbo, the plot of Dumbo is very similar to the plot of, it's such as it is, of my book. I mean, that it is about a mother abandoning her child, really. But when I chose Dumbo to be the film, it was really because it was the right date, rather than because I was aware of the kind of thematic sort of, you know, union of it.
But there's no censure for Iris for doing that in the book. You're very tolerant, is that not?
I try to be tolerant because I think that I do try to be tolerant. I think Iris, the woman who abandons her child, is not really a very likeable character, and she's quite brittle as women, I think, where I sort of remember my grandmother being rather like that. And but I thought it was too sort of obvious to kind of be blaming and things. I wanted to explore why people do things, not sort of censure them for it.
Exploration is just the right word. It seems to me that one of the things the novel can do is to talk about things which we generally gloss over it elsewhere.
Mm.
And it's about broken families. But in fact, it takes a quite sort of interesting and I think, you know, very, very kind of balanced and rather kind of rather kind of probing view of what it is that breaks up families. Because in fact, there are three generations here, and looking at it objectively, you could say they all go to pieces.
They do all go to pieces, and it's meant to have, and I hope does have, kind of almost every kind of love. So it's got, you know, filial love and married love and parental love
and lesbian love.
Lesbian love and gay love, and also, you know, I hope it's got, it sort of spans all of the, well, not all of the possibilities, and the love of animals, love of both pet animals and nature. And because I wanted to look at that.
Which of the four characters in the three generations, principal characters, did you feel closest to, or did you like, or were there anything you didn't? I mean, very often novelists create characters they don't like. Or
I liked the central character, Ruth, the best. I liked her because she was so sort of ordinary in a way. And funnily enough, I got a letter from a friend who'd read it and said, I can't believe you've written a book about somebody so ordinary. But in a way, that's the whole point, that she isn't meant to be a remarkable person. She's meant to be quite a kind of straightforward person, really. That, you know, somebody that life happens to, rather than she hasn't got an incredible amount of agency. She's not very, what would now be called, proactive. She's sort of rather passive in a way. I like her. I like her sort of courage and... Yes, I like her. I like the way she's not spoilt.
It's a woman's novel.
It is.
And one of the feelings I got from the novel was it's so hard, historically, these periods you're writing about, for women to fulfil themselves.
Mm.
You feel a terrific frustration. Is that something in the novel?
I think so, and I think none of them really fulfil their potential. You know, I think all of the four women in the book have more potential than their working lives allow them to, you know, utilise, really. So yes, that is there.
Why does Iris actually walk out on her daughter?
Well, Iris it's a muddled... Well, another of the themes of the book, in a way, is about the muddle that people get into, how people don't know the most obvious things about each other. So it opens with this scene in the cinema where the mother thinks that she sees her lover on a newsreel. And this was a thing that actually did happen to my grandmother and my mother at the cinema, although I think they were seeing another film, I don't know which one. And so she walks out on her daughter because she wants to go and find this lover that she thinks might have died, and she sees him on a news clip of the Middle East. And so she wants to get out there and manages to get herself posted somehow out there. But the daughter, Ruth, all her life believes that her mother thinks that she saw her father, her actual, you know, the man she's married to, but it isn't him. And so that's why she leaves, really. And I don't think she really gives it much of a backward glance. I don't think it's something she feels guilty about as a mother today would. I think during those times, a lot of women, well, you said your mother went to Argentina, you know, that women didn't feel such, perhaps they weren't readers of Freud.
It takes a long time to forgive your parents, doesn't it?
Yes.
And very often it's too late. I mean, you have to throw letters in at the gravestone. I'm not prying into your own life.
Yes.
In fact, you have a very distinguished surname in literary terms. I wonder if I could just change the ground a bit.
Of course.
I mean, you're a woman of letters who's established herself professionally. Why did you decide to write a novel? Which I think is your first novel, is that right?
It's my first novel. I always thought I'd only ever write short stories. I love short stories really best of kinds of writing. But it began to nibble away at me and demand to come out. And so it just sort of turned into a novel, really. I got very stuck in the middle when Ruth, my central character, has an unhappy experience and thought perhaps I ought to go back to writing a short story. But I managed to press on, so yes. Yeah.
Tell me,
Could we just cut for 1 second?
What do you think novels can do? I mean, obviously they make you a bit of money, they can actually get you a little bit of fame, but why novels? I mean, they're sort of... Sometimes the simplest questions are the hardest to answer, aren't they?
Yes, well, that's a very hard question. I mean, I think novels can do anything is the answer to that. I think they're sort of magic devices, like tellies or cinema screens. And that, you know, the human desire for narrative, for stories, is so, so great. It's sort of... So I think that's what novels are for. They're to answer our yearning for stories and for explanations of life, perhaps.
One of the things which the judges on this prize, Fiction Uncovered... We all enjoyed the novel immensely. In fact, there was a lot of kind of praise for... It just sounds condescending. A lot of praise for the sheer quality of writing. You're very, very, very good with the pen. But one of the things that was brought up was, it didn't seem to end. And it seems to me that there's something very factitious, there's something very artificial, isn't there, about ending. It seems
yes.
You rather actually sort of, that it's almost like the novel opened rather than closing.
Yes, well, I wanted it, because in the end, it is about rather ordinary lives in a sort of a way. I thought that if it had a sort of terrifically grand ending, that wasn't really, you know, it wasn't of a piece with who the characters were. And so I wanted it to end with this, I'd always known it would end with this thing of hearing that piece of Bach music, which is about having enough in your life and being satisfied with what you have rather than yearning for more all the time. So that is quite kind of open in a way, it's true.
Are the granddaughters, you know, in our period, happier or unhappier than their kind of predecessors?
Gosh, that's a question. I think they are almost unhappier. I think they're unhappier. I think it's more difficult for people to be happy than it used to be in a way, because people's expectations are so much greater and, you know, the marketplace is applied to everything. So people sort of think they can shop for happiness now in a way that I think people didn't used to think that. I think people used to make do and mend much more with their lives. So, yes, I think perhaps they're less happy, but they're not very fulfilled in their working lives, perhaps, as well.
Because they have more options? Would that actually add to the, as it were, the...
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think it yes.
It's interesting. It would have to be described as a woman's novel, because all the principal characters are women. But
yes.
You'd be very hard put to slap the label feminist on it, wouldn't you?
It isn't really a feminist book, I don't think. I mean, a writer who I love very much is Elizabeth Bowen, who I'd been reading. So I suppose in a way it's that sort of novel, or Elizabeth Taylor, or those people. I'm not saying I'm as good as them, of course, but just it's more a novel of that kind. So it's not directly it's not a feminist. It's not a treatise. No, it's not a feminist. It's not overtly feminist.
No, but you know, obviously you're very familiar with the, you know, the kind of Elaine Showalter thesis, the literature of their own, that the novel is one of the few places historically where women could talk to women. It was one of the few places where they could express themselves without the constraints of a, you know, what D.H. Lawrence calls the man's world.
Yes.
Is that your feeling as well?
Yes, I think that's... I'm not familiar with that thesis, actually, but I think that most of what happens to most people, most of what matters to most people happens inside their houses. I think that, you know, that's why it's, you know, it's not a book that... It's not a sort of picaresque adventure. It is a book that's quite an interior book, both, you know, the interior of the people, but also a lot of it happens just in a domestic sphere. But in a way, I don't see a need to apologise for that, because that is how it is for most people.
No, I mean, interior is just the right word. Mm. I'd like to go back to the passage you chose to read, which is all interiority. It's all about the inside of a woman's body. It seems to me that we're now in a phase... I mean, D.H. Lawrence's novels, which were, you know, written, you know, in the early 20th century, he liked women as his principal characters, because he felt they were more sensitive, they were more receptive. But in fact, it seems to me now we've come round to saying that no man can know what it is to be a woman. And the passage you chose, it seems to me, is something that no man could possibly understand.
I mean, yes.
the insertion of a diaphragm, Dutch cats. It does seem to me there's certain kind of women actually sort of do find a way of actually being women in the novel. It's something rather hard outside.
Yes. Well, I suppose a man can know, because a man can read a book that has somebody telling him about it, just
so
as a woman can know.
Who's your ideal reader then, Cressa?
I haven't really got an ideal reader. I don't know anybody. I haven't got an ideal reader.
You don't think of someone when you're writing, sort of listening to
you? I don't actually. No, strangely enough, I don't. It's more about needing to write something that can't really be said in conversation. That's what sort of propels writing, more than imagining a reader. It's wanting to explore something that can't just be said, you know. So that's the impulse, more than imagining somebody reading it, is to say what you can't say in your daily life, in a way.
You're a woman of letters. The two novelists you've mentioned as influential, Elizabeth Bowen and Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, what's happening, in your view, to fiction at the moment? It's a constantly mutating, changing, evolving form.
Absolutely.
And you've got your obviously got your fingers on the pulse. What do you think is happening with fiction at the moment?
Well, I think lots of interesting and exciting things are happening. I think it's a very good moment for fiction. There's a lot of fiction being published. A lot of people are reading fiction. And it seems to be, to me, I think publishers perhaps might disagree because they're so nervous about all the modern things that may take over from books, but it seems to me a wonderful moment in fiction. There's wonderful writing, historical fiction and marvellous stories. I think there's wonderful work being produced everywhere and a lot of nice, interesting young American writers. I think it's a great moment for fiction.
I agree. I think sociologically
Sorry,
what's happening...
Can we just pause a second?
Someone in here. Very sorry, it's just...
It's
getting a bit too noisy outside.
Don't worry, John.
Who do you like?
I don't know, really. I'm sort of actually overwhelmed in some ways. And,
yeah.
Okay,
and rolling?
Just to come this late. It's moving over towards me.
Is that okay?
You
still got it?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
And? Hold.
Cressida, you know, My Former Heart is, in fact, got a rather kind of a title that could do well for Milton Boone in some way. It's a woman's novel, but one would be very hard put to label it as a feminist novel. I mean, do you see a distinction there at all?
I don't. It's not a polemic. It's not a feminist novel particularly, except for that it is about women.
You could call a feminist novel a woman's novel which is angry.
You could, but it isn't angry. It's not angry, it's resigned. So maybe that's not...
Sad. Really, yeah, that's interesting. What do you see happening to fiction at the moment? Are you optimistic about the genre?
Yes, I am. I think wonderful things are happening in fiction. It seems to be ever expanding. There are wonderful short story writers out there and...
So on the question of expansion, are you going to expand it yourself? Are you going to write a second novel?
I am going to write a second novel. I'm finding it difficult to get going with my second novel because it's about baddies rather than, as it were, goodies. The people in my second novel I don't like very much and they're snobs and I don't like them. So it's not very enjoyable to spend time in their company. So I'm rather kind of limping along rather slowly.
I was rather hoping you'd say you're going to a sequence, that you're going to a sequel to My Former Heart, because in fact the characters are all there at the end, aren't they?
Yes, they are, sort of poised, yeah,
and all, to some extent waiting. You know, one wonder what, I mean, do you see a future for the third generation?
I don't at the moment, no, because I've got this other project in mind, which is sort of based on my husband's grandmother, who was a black shirt sympathiser in the Second World War and was imprisoned with Diana Mosley and so on. And so I'm going to look at them next, I think.
It's very strange that the judges in Fiction Uncovered noticed that there were a lot of novels, particularly by women, incidentally, which went back, you know, a lifespan, 60 years.
Yes.
And there were at least four or five novels about the period of the Second World War. Why is that? I mean, I don't know.
I wonder if it's in people's unconscious about the Queen's Jubilee or something, if that's bringing things up, or whether that's just the natural span of nostalgia, or I don't know.
Well, usually it's the period of a lifetime, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the last living touch you have with the past. But the novel seems to be very magnetically drawn to that. And
that's
it's interesting that you are, because your novel begins, in fact, in 42.
Yes, it does. Well, in real life, I'm a great collector of Lady Bird books, which are actually a later period. They're the 60s. And when I was in my sort of fever of collecting them worst, I realised that I was really single-handedly trying to kind of preserve the whole of that period, and I started collecting crockery and games and all sorts of things, and I realised it was a sort of almost like a kind of madness to try and stop time passing. And of course that's what fiction enables you as a writer to do, is to hold something in amber, to stop it, arrest its passing. And I kind of miss those voices, you know. My father was quite old. He was born in 1904, so I grew up in a way with people with kind of Edwardian ways of talking, and I suppose I have a kind of nostalgia for people who spoke in that way. So that would be my own personal reason for wanting to start there. I like the way they spoke then.
It is interesting. I mean, obviously, you know, life is lived forward, but it's also understood backwards, isn't it?
Of course.
It's not just a question of, as it were, preserving it in a museum way. It's a question of understanding it, making sense of it.
Yes.
And I wonder when you look back at the past, I mean, it's a... one of the interesting things is that, you'll forgive me saying this, but you've decided to write your first novel at a mature stage of life, mm. when to some extent you do have more past than mm. many young novelists.
Yes. I think that's right. Well, I was looking after children and dithering. So, yes, that's why it took me a bit of time. But, yes, it's true. You do. And I'm actually glad, because I think that, you know, it takes a long time to process things that happen and to understand about life a bit better. So I think, it, you know, although there's a great deal to be said for being a young gun blazing, it's also quite nice to have a more reflective and, you know, contemplative attitude that age brings. So, I, you know, it each have their advantages.
Well, it also gives you, to some extent, I think, the ability to do what you do extremely well in this novel, which is to cover a lot of time very, very kind of concretely. So, in fact, one feels there are moments, mm. real moments right the way through. But to cover, you know, well, about 80 years, in fact.
Yes, it is. It's a long span.
It is a very difficult thing. I always think people ought to try and write novels just to realise how difficult it is. Yeah, everyone thinks they can, but yes. no one thinks they can pick up a violin and do a Yehudi Menuhin. But everyone thinks, I can write a novel.
It's true.
It is very, very difficult. What difficulties did you face in writing this?
The difficulties I faced, well, because I had done, I'd written a biography before, so that made me feel that I did know how to assemble the scaffolding to make a longer work, as it were, than a short story. So it wasn't so much that, but I found it very difficult with the content. I found it very difficult making my character suffer, and all my characters suffer, because if you love, you do suffer. So I did find that very hard. I hated being kind of unkind to them and making bad things happen to them. And obviously it's got death and, you know, partings and so on. So that was where I found it hard. Yeah, I found that difficult.
There's quite a lot of kind of suffering in the novel, isn't there? I mean it's not exactly a kind of a weepy, but on the other hand, it's sort of, it doesn't really, neither is it kind of sort of rose-tinted.
Well, I hope that's sort of like life itself. I hope that's how I see life, as having suffering, but with lovely moments.
We're talking at the moment at a time when you will have seen Seven Up, that wonderful Michael Apted.
Absolutely.
And you do get that strange sort of, it rather kind of eerie sense of, you know, time, a lot of time passing,
yes.
and how it changes things.
And how poignant it is seeing those children so full of optimism at the beginning, and then their kind of acceptance of life not being so, having opened out quite as much as, I don't know, yes.
But there is a wonderful moment at the beginning of the novel when you know, the heroine decides to go out and, you know, like Lawrence of Arabia, go to foreign fathers and find the man she loves.
Yes.
And it works out, actually.
Yes.
You could have finished the novel there, couldn't you? You could have written a whole
yes.
novel like
yes.
that.
Yes. Funnily enough, that bit came from Lady Bird books.
Did it?
By a roundabout route. But the place that I write about, which was called the Cedars in the Lebanon, which was where they trained alpine skiers for Second World War things. It was a real place, and there's a sort of link to Lady Bird books, which is how I came upon it in the first place. So yes,
that's great. You're a critic. What's your feeling about the state of fiction, the English novel, the English short story at the moment? Do you think it's in a good place?
I think it's in a really good place. Yes, yeah. I do think it's in a very good place. There are a lot of really good writers.
So why do we need these lies? Why do we need things that never happened? There never was a character called Ruth. There never was a character called Iris.
I think we need stories. We need, you know, the.
But why?
I think it speaks to a sort of ancient. I think it must have gone on, you know, Neolithic times. I think we must have all been huddled round fires telling stories.
So what you mean? You'd be there, sort of doing your little daubs on the cave wall in the Cro-Magnon sort of society. Yes, interesting. Yeah. Well, you were brought up in a literary world, of course. I mean, forgive me bringing in the.
No,
personal.
Of course.
Did that affect you at all? I mean, there must have been quite a lot of printer's ink in your bloodstream.
Well, there was certainly a lot of, you know, there were a lot of books in the house I grew up in, that was true. And there were a lot of books, and I suppose that it was quite highbrow. You know, Enid Blyton was disapproved of, and, you know, you were supposed to read proper things. So I think it did have an influence, yes. I mean, I think it did, yes. I wouldn't have been allowed to read Harry Potter, I don't think.
No. You had enough?
Yeah, I think that's probably about enough time. Yeah.
Yes?
That's okay, thank you.
Lovely.
Okay, great. Sound?
Sound coming in. You're good. And? Just hold, please. Set.
All right, Cressida, cut to the commercial. What does it mean to you to have won, or at least to have been placed in the ensemble of winners in the Fiction Uncovered competition.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's fantastic. It's a lovely feeling to feel that somebody likes your work and that, you know, that it's been, especially somebody as distinguished as you. It's very exciting. It's great. I didn't go to university, so I feel incredibly sort of starstruck that somebody so posh in academia would like my book. So
loved it, in fact. I sort of it's very nice. I still like being transported. You know, I say that first scene really actually sort of touched me very powerfully. I read it several times, and it brought back a lot to me. I wonder, you know, it's a complicated novel. I wonder if you could possibly just give us, you know, your version of the outline, observing the necessary spoiler alert stuff.
Yes. Well, it's really it's a book that spans three generations of the same family. Primarily the women. There's a grandmother and her daughter Ruth, who's born in about 1930, and then Ruth's own two daughters up until sort of the late 1970s, and it looks at their lives, and particularly through the lens of sort of love and their emotional lives, really. So in that sense it's perhaps rather an old-fashioned novel, and yes, so I'm sorry, I'm completely stuck. I don't know what to say.
Should we go back to this top and do that again?
Yes.
From where?
Just the synopsis, an outline of the story. That would be great.
I mean, if you were writing your own blurb, how would you actually synopsize your book?
Well, it's a book, it's a multi-generational book. It's a book about four generations of the same family, primarily the women, although there are men in the book. It's not a book completely empty of men, but it's mostly seen through the eyes of the women. And it starts in the Second World War and looks at that, and then moves forward into the 1950s and on up until the 1970s, and looks at the different ways in which people experience relationships during that time and so on. So yes, it's primarily a book about the heart, as its title might suggest, although I hope not in a Mills and Boone way.
Lovely.